A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm Spanners, the host and producer of Missed Apex. We are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. I'm joined in the shed by someone who has interviewed all the great names in today's Formula One, but today we're turning the mic on him. It's F1 journalist and broadcaster Chris Medland. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Spanners. How you doing?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for joining us in the shed.
That's all right. It's lovely surroundings.
Yeah. Everyone loves being in the shed, especially Joe, who joins us on about a monthly basis. Always speaks very highly of you, Chris. Always uses you as an example of as someone who was thrusting and just got out there into the world of journalism and media and just went and did it.
Yeah, I got a bit of help from Joe, actually. I first started off doing the British Grand Prix media services team just to sort of get in at a race paddock and see how it all worked and get an understanding for it. And Joe was one of the first people I was introduced to by one of the guys there saying, here's some people you should chat to who help young journalists quite often. So he let me write a feature, actually, on his website when he was running GrandPrix.com and opened a few doors there, and away it went.
When you started, was that in around, what, 2007, 2008?
2008, yeah. First one was 2008 when Lewis won in the wet at Silverstone. So I did 3 years there. I was at uni at the time doing sports journalism. And yeah, it was a really good way of spending a weekend in the summer.
See, I was a bit of a latecomer to the internet. Genuinely thought it was a bit of a fad. And around 2008, did you have the level of internet media, internet reporters that we have today? Or was the only option to just go and turn up on track?
Yeah, you had a lot less of it, mainly because the way that Bernie used to run F1 and the FIA's regulations meant you couldn't really get accredited as a journalist. You had to be, as an online journalist, you had to have a sort of print publication to go with or be a broadcaster. And slowly it opened up. But yeah, at those times, it was online was like a little bit of a side thing that they didn't take quite so seriously. So yeah, Formula One, I think, was one of the later sports to really cotton on to what the internet could give it.
Do you think they'll ever cotton on to what podcasts can give it, Chris? I'm asking for a friend, asking for a friend.
I think they're getting there. There's some pretty good ones out there, this being one of them. But yeah, it's definitely a growing market. And yeah, I think there'll be a few more springing up as well. So I think they're just about picking up on it.
Now, normally, as we head into the summer break, we kind of think, oh no, this is a nightmare. There's 3 weeks now without Formula One. But is there a sense in the F1 community that after the last four crazy races, actually, we could use a bit of a break?
A little bit, yeah. But on a personal level, I was exhausted after Hungary. But that was more, I blame Germany for that one, because race day at Hockenheim, by the time you got to the end of that day, you were shattered. Trying to watch that race and follow everything that was going on and understand all of the different sort of aspects of it and everyone's individual races was just so tiring. I had such a headache by the end of it. And there's about five laps to go where you still weren't convinced who was going to finish where. And you're thinking, I need to write a report here. What's gone on? So yeah, that was a tough weekend. And then yeah, to go straight into Hungary as well was busy. But to be fair, you know, that's from my perspective as a journalist, but you think of the mechanics and the engineers and the team members that are just flat out the whole time. They work some brutal hours as well. They genuinely do need, it's stupid, isn't it, really? But we have to force them to take 2 weeks off. We have to write it into the rules because otherwise people wouldn't stop. So that's just the nature of the beast, really.
Yeah, people who do things out of passion and not just to feed their families are crazy and strange individuals. How do you follow a race? So, I mean, we're always torn. Do we catch some radio commentary, watch it on TV, follow it in live text? Joe Sayward, for example, follows it with a pen and pencil and doesn't listen to any of the in-race commentary. How do you follow a race?
Very similar, actually. So not pen and pencil. I'm not quite as old school as Joe with his race chart or the lap charts, but they're really good for refreshing your memory and sort of getting an understanding of how a race panned out. But for me, yeah, we don't get any commentary in the media center. You're just reliant on the pictures, the team radio that comes in, and the timing screens. So you get a couple of different ones that normally have race control messages and all the different sectors, so you can see how maybe an individual race is panning out based on lap times and sector times, even if you're not seeing the pictures on track. But that's only if I'm in the media center. So sometimes I'm out in the TV pen and you're reliant on one screen with the TV pictures, one timing screen if you're lucky, and if you can see it, and maybe get the app up and try and get some team radio that way. And Twitter.
Yeah. Because Twitter's always right, of course, and everyone agrees. So that's good. Yeah. So you produce content for Racer magazine.
Racer magazine and racer.com, yeah, online, so, over in America.
Does that get you into the driver pen bit where you have to shove a microphone in the driver's face?
No, so that's a different bit of my work. So I'm freelance, so I have my own, technically I have my own company, and I do the Racer stuff, gets me into the media center. So they're who I'm accredited under, but then I do some work for Formula One themselves. And that's normally when I'm in the driver pen doing interviews, either for Formula One to do their own paddock pass shows and the things that Will Buxton often does. It's normally if he's got a Twitter live show to worry about, I then go into the pen to help out. Or for NBC, the Middle East broadcaster, I do some work for them. So I normally do pre-qualifying and pre-race. I do their live TV shows, sort of as a bit of a pundit and as an interviewer. Do the grid walk for them. And then obviously all their outputs in Arabic. So I'm kind of like the link between all the people on the grid and doing the interviews in English and the Arabic presenters. So it's quite good fun to do.
Can we see the Medland grid walk anywhere? Does it rival the Brundle pit walk?
If it rivals it, it rivals it badly in the way that we were talking before we started this is Yeovil Town's my football team. And it's in the same way we rival Bristol City. We're about four divisions apart, but we like to think we can still challenge. So I'm a long way off Brundle's standard, but it's good fun to do. And we had some fun in Budapest, actually. But I myself have never got to see it back because it's only broadcast in the Middle East. It's a big region. It's the whole of the Middle East. So there's a lot of people that can see it, but I've yet to find out how I can watch it back, which I'd like to do sometime just to see how stupid I look.
Obviously, you have the envy of all us bedroom and shed dwellers sticking a microphone in the face of the drivers straight after the race. I suppose it's useful that you're not listening to the same race commentary as everyone. I suppose your questions could easily get led by, say, the Sky commentary team. So it means you're asking fresh and different questions. But do you have... I'm not going to ask you which are the worst drivers to speak to, but there must be some drivers where you go, brilliant. I know I'm going to get value out of, say, Hülkenberg.
Definitely not Hülkenberg, but yes, you're okay. Right. Hülkenberg tends to disappear as quickly as possible and try and avoid doing as much media as he can, even more so than Kimi, I think. But Daniel Ricciardo, no one will be surprised to hear, is always good value. The first 20 seconds of the interview I did with him post-race on Sunday in the TV pen was him just trying to get a sneeze to come out. So there was no words. Just some strange faces. And it made for great telly. Daniel's very good. Lando Norris is excellent. Carlos Sainz as well. Both McLaren guys are very good. Charles Leclerc also tends to be very good. Most of them are good.
Is it the younger guys who have kind of come through watching a different kind of TV coverage and then they've come up and gone, actually, I'm on telly. Like a lot of the job is being on telly. I'd better work on being on telly.
I think a little bit, yeah. For a lot of them, it's just quite fun to do and quite cool to do. And I'm lucky now that I've just about been around long enough that I was there before the drivers were for a lot of them. So there's a little bit more of, I guess it just a natural respect comes from them that you're someone they've seen doing it before. Whereas understandably for some of the older drivers, they're just like, who's this guy who's sticking a microphone in my face? Like, I get enough of this and I've had enough of this. So their relationship's been built up with others. But to be fair, for the older ones, someone like Lewis is excellent most of the time. you ask him a good question and gives you a really good answer. So that helps. I did some BBC Five Live stuff last year, and I think he does see the outlets and understand the need to talk to those as well. So yeah, he's normally very good. He actually got some stick on Sunday for being late to the press conference, the print one, because he was still doing television interviews, because he wants to talk and he's asked a question, he wants to give a good answer. So he's just doing his duty and doing it well. So I do feel sometimes he gets a bit of stick that's unfair there in that sense. But yeah, he's one of the good ones as well.
One of the good ones to interview. Is it not overly robotic? Because I think a lot of people criticize Lewis Hamilton for always saying, I just want to thank the team, I want to thank the fans, doing all the corporate speak first. I think something that very much started in the Mercedes days.
Yeah, I think part of that as well comes from the immediate reaction points. So when he's getting interviewed on the grid after qualifying or after the race, that's when he seems to tick those boxes as such. It's almost like his first thought is, I need to get those in. And then by the time he's doing sort of working his way around the TV pen, because they do so many interviews within that little space, he's loosened up and really worked what he wants to cover off. So he's kind of thinking, right, what is it I want to say? And he almost gets more comfortable. A lot of the drivers do that. They kind of perfect their answer over the first two or three answers, and then they give a really nice one by the time you're the sort of the fourth interview.
So you want to make sure you shuffle around the pen. So you're one of the middle ones at least. It's an underrated skill, I suppose, because we see our one interview on the one outlet we're watching. We forget that they probably get asked the same question 10, 15, 20 times. And it never feels like that. So they must get media training of how to reset and treat each question as if it's a new day.
A little bit. I think they get advice rather than training. For some of the drivers, there's proper training that goes on. For others, they don't want to do that because they want the driver to be as natural as possible. But then when they're being difficult and being hard work, that's when the team steps in and says, look, you need to get a bit better at resetting between every answer, just understanding why different groups are asking you the same thing over and over again. But it is just the way it's organized, is the drivers have to work their way through all the different television outlets, essentially, and radio outlets. And each one is only going to get one answer out of that driver, and they need to record it to use. And it tends to be sort of the same question, even as basic as how was your race? But they have to go over it again and again.
All right. What about when a guy has had an absolute stinker? I guess you have to harden yourself, because for me, as a kind of a modern millennial snowflake, if I've seen someone who's having a really bad day, I'd be like, oh, do you know what? I might just leave them alone. But you've got to approach them. That's quite an awkward situation at times.
Yeah, it certainly can be. It's not like you go and pester them. They come and stand in front of you knowing you're about to ask them a question. And it's more then thinking about how you word it, maybe giving them the time to give a full answer, pushing at the right times, not pushing at other times, and also knowing when the interview's over, when you're not going to get anything else out of them. Certainly nothing better, and all you're going to do is really anger them. Because that doesn't make for good TV if it's just them getting angry at you, basically. It might be maybe once, but if you sort of burn that bridge just to try and rile up a driver when you can tell that they've had a bad day.
Next time.
All you want them to do is actually talk. So you're just trying to coax it out of them more than anything.
And then just give them a big metaphorical hug. They're there, yeah. Roman. But let's get an insight into you a little bit. I could see in your eyes that you've got a bit of a petrol heads mentality on your video for Racer magazine, where you interviewed Lando Norris around the Shanghai circuit. That looked like a lot of fun.
Yeah, that was awesome. That was that was really kind of set up for me by someone at McLaren who did me a big favour that weekend. I was really grateful. Got to go out there with Lando, and we managed to cover it off. We did it for NBC as well. We did a bit of a track guide in there, but for Racer, I just got to ask him some sort of quick fire questions and different questions, something about the Indy 500, just try and cram in as much as we could. And it's amazing how quickly the lap goes, because you think, because you're in a road car, it's going to be a little while, but they're lapping these circuits in under 2 minutes in a Formula One car. You're only looking at like 3 minutes in a road car. So you suddenly find yourself on the back straight doing 200 kilometers an hour in no time, and you're thinking, I've got half the questions still to ask here.
Yeah, and I mean, half of that time must be just struggling to breathe. Now, you put on a brave front at the beginning and asked him to get sideways. Was that bravado, or did you really want to see what the car could do?
I wanted to see what the car could do. I mean, you've got to trust these guys. They're so good at what they do. I'd rather have any one of them driving me than me be behind the wheel. You want to, it kind of going to show it off. I've done some really cool stuff like that in the past. Mario Andretti did a two-seater ride with him at Indianapolis. And you're going so quickly, but you've just got complete faith because they can do it a hell of a lot better than I can.
Was that the two-seater F1 car?
The two-seater IndyCar.
Oh, wow. I bet that was terrifying. I mean, that there's no halo, there's no roof, just you and your little helmet. That must be horrendous.
Well, you're kind of almost kneeling. You're kind of your knees are right in front of your body because there's nowhere to sort of put your legs.
Either so side. You don't cradle him with your knees and calves.
Not quite. Yeah. You can't see a lot because you've just got a headrest in front of you and then that driver. So you're looking sort of either side of them and you're trying to look into the next corner as it comes. But it's just all you're feeling really is the physics on you, so the G-force, the acceleration, and the cornering, and it was incredible. It was so much fun. So but yeah, you trust these guys because they've done it a million times, and if I was behind the wheel, as much as I'd love to have a go, far more likely to get it wrong. So yeah, you say to them, show me what it's really like.
Are you not worried that you're going to like distract Lando Norris? I mean, he's only like 18 or something. Don't you want to just keep your eyes on the road, Lando? I'll ask you the questions at the end.
No, to be honest, I would have preferred it if he'd have done what he did at Silverstone and he got it wrong with Johnny Herbert and ended up in the gravel. That would have been great because then you've finally seen that they're human. But I still think he'd left so much margin. We got a bit sideways a few times, but I think he could have done a lot more if he was really willing to risk it. But they're still having some fun, but I think they're worried about someone's helmet smashing through the window if they go too quickly around a corner. Whatever, so they're still leaving plenty of margin.
So you don't fancy yourself as a racer, as a karter, perhaps?
I do a bit of karting every now and then. No, I don't mind jumping in a go-kart. We did a race a couple of weeks ago here in the UK, just an arrive and drive, pay as you go thing, and I got a very nicely tuned kart and finished second in that, so I got a little trophy. So I can point one in the right direction, but no, when it comes to the good guys, I get really shown up.
Who's the fastest journalist? I've shared a track with Will Buxton, who's incredibly quick in a go-kart. Can you rival him?
Yeah, I can give Will a decent run for his money at the right track. I'm trying to remember when we last went racing together. We haven't done it that often. He wasn't in a different league, I'd say, but Ben Anderson, who is now the editor of F1 Racing, who used to do a lot of karting and club racing, still does some club racing, I think. He's very quick in a go-kart. Yeah, I'm trying to just get lighter because that's how you get free lap time, isn't it? So I'm working on that.
Oh, I can't relate. I'm very lithe, as far as you can tell from this camera angle.
a guy called Lawrence Edmondson at ESPN, he's pretty quick behind a wheel as well. He used to do some karting at university. So there's a few of these guys that have done it before, whereas I've only done it arrive and drive, having a bit of fun.
I would have thought you guys would be constantly out on go-kart tracks. I thought that would have been like half your... We imagine a very glamorous lifestyle for you guys. And Joe always tries to pretend there's not a second to spare. Surely that can't be the case. Tell me you're soaking up the paddock atmosphere. You're at parties at the Sunday night. Tell me you're taking advantage of this dream you're living.
I wish I could. It's not quite as bad as maybe Joe's just made out, in the sense that we try and get the odd bit of karting in when we can, but that would normally be a Wednesday. You'd arrive, you fly in on the Wednesday. Hopefully you've done most of your work and you'll go to the nearest kart track for an hour or two and then grab some dinner. But then from Thursday morning, you're off flat out, basically. The only socializing is over dinner, that's normally late each evening. In Budapest, there's a bunch of parties Sunday night, but had so much work to do, didn't leave the track till like 10 p.m. You go and get a late dinner, you go to bed, get up early, did some more work before heading to the airport again. So, there's the odd, I'm not saying there's never a good night. I mean, there's a few later finishes in Hungary where you go and enjoy the atmosphere a bit. But on the whole, the whole reason you're there is because the work's allowing you to, and you try and take the perks when you get them. But at the same time, you've got to appreciate you've got a job to do.
All right. Well, listener, I don't believe him. It's a conspiracy. I think he's been ordered by Joe. Whatever Spanners asks you, just say it's boring. We don't want him trying to get into the paddock.
It's certainly not boring. I'll say that. No, it's a great way to earn a living.
I was just wondering, like, obviously you build relationships with people at teams, engineers, mechanics. Is it ever possible to build anything more than, a good working relationship? Because there's a kind of hunter prey mentality. If you're out for a pint with a Red Bull mechanic, he's always thinking, well, that's going to end up on Twitter tomorrow.
No, I'd say it's definitely doable. I think that it depends on the person you are as a journalist, but also the person that the other team member is. But it's very clear to me, at least, where the lines are. So once you've left the paddock, anything that you speak about there is off record, unless you genuinely say, I want to know this for a certain reason. So now I've got some really close friends in different teams, and I do bits of work for different teams as well, and for Honda as well at times.
Really?
Because, I mean, one, the beauty of an NDA means there's only so much you can learn and can use and that sort of thing. But also, it's a relationship built on trust. And if there's something that, as a journalist, I want to know, I go and ask and I say, I want to know, and I want to know it for this reason. And I think now with so many different media outlets as well and different ways of working, you kind of need that approach. But no, I'd say I've got some really good friends in different teams. And yeah, as long as you approach it the right way and trust each other, then there's some stuff you hear that you think, oh, I can't use that. There's other times you hear it and say, I could really do with using that. And if they trust you, they're going to go, well, you know, feel free to ask the question to the right person or whatever. That's how it kind of, how those relationships work.
What about when it comes up, like if you're being interviewed by Sky or something and they say, oh, well, you know, if only we knew this about the current Honda situation, and you're there going, I know full well what's going on. And then you lie to camera saying, oh, well, we'll just have to see.
It's rare to lie. And to be honest, I can't really think of many situations where I've been put in that situation. But more the way I look at it is it's better. It means you don't get it wrong when you could get it wrong if you're speculating or guessing. And I think with there's so much coverage of Formula One these days, and, you know, Sky has its own F1 channel. But, you know, so many different outlets have different ways of covering the sport that you can get into the realms of speculation quite easily sometimes. And at the very least, I know when not to say something or what would be the wrong thing to say, even if from the outside I'd normally believe it. So there's been a few times when you've known stuff ahead of time, you can't say anything, but it just means you're not getting it wrong. You might not be able to say, oh, I know. And that's just when you have to have an ego that doesn't get too bruised, because other people are eventually going to beat you to it or might beat you to it.
I suppose a situation where you would have had to have kept a few things under your chest and under wraps would have been the Netflix series Drive to Survive. Tell us a bit about your involvement with those guys.
Yeah, that was one where I wasn't allowed to say a lot originally, just based on anything they were filming, who they were working with in the first series. But that came about in Melbourne. I think it was James Allen was kind enough to sort of recommend me. The Netflix guys came in and said, we want a few journalists of like different ages and experience to talk about the sport. And then it kind of got honed, and they centered in on, actually, they just wanted a couple of talking heads, because originally they didn't want to do it as talking heads. They wanted to make sure that, okay, there's voiced over, but that you never saw someone just talking to a camera. And then they changed the approach there. So then it became right for context to help explain things, you know, some of it on a very basic level, which tended to be where they called on me to say, what do you do on a Friday? What happens on a Saturday? So yeah, I got to give that huge insight of the fact that we'd go racing on a Sunday. But they used that as sort of the laying the foundation so that new fans or just new viewers could understand what was going on within the sport. So
It was a nice breakup with like just lots of inside talking to the team people, and then we'll come back to like some studio with the talking head, then back out to the action. Just from anecdotal experience, I felt like our podcast numbers took a huge uptick when the Drive to Arrive series came in, and we've had lots of emails and interactions from people saying that was their way into the sport. Is that how it's been received in the F1 community, that it's given the sport this big boost?
Yeah, I'd say so. I think one of the things I noticed was on Reddit, there was a huge sort of thread set up that was, you know, for new fans that had come in and gone, right, I've watched Drive to Survive or seen it, and what else do I need to know? And there's so many of them that were popping up. They had to sort of put them all together in one place. Certainly, yeah, you just notice it on things like social media followers and stuff like that. People start saying, oh, I saw you on this, thought it was very cool, and your numbers just go up. Off the back of that, then you get things like more work because you're more recognizable. And I think within the sport, they had the same thing. And Gunther Steiner says he still hasn't watched it and won't watch it. But it made him a bit of a cult hero. So,
yeah,
a lot of people have seen that increase. And Christian Horner as well. He didn't always come off great in it, and he acknowledges that. But at the same time, he saw the benefit for the sport and saw an increase in sort of awareness of him as well. So, yeah, I think the sport as a whole really benefited. And the fact that Mercedes and Ferrari have now got involved this year, and Mercedes have been very good with being heavily involved over the last two races, shows that they saw the value beyond just what they could personally command.
Oh, quick question then, because I got told that they were only doing the German Grand Prix for the Netflix series. Did they extend to Hungary just because the German one was such a disaster?
It appeared that way. The Netflix cameras were a lot closer around Lewis again in Hungary, but I didn't see in which context they're allowed to go. But I got the feeling that they'd kind of left that door a bit open to them because it was very clever of Mercedes and very good of them as well, and brave that they'd had a bad weekend and that stuff's all going to be recorded. But then they were saying, right, we're going to also show you a bit how we're going to bounce back. I believe they got some more access there too. And I don't know to which extent, but I do believe they were open to it.
And have you watched the series back with the bits with you in it? Because
yeah. Yeah, I I cringe at those bits. I watched it on the plane to Australia this year, actually, because everyone said, you know, you've got to download it before the flight, and it's so long to get over there. And it was quite quick to fire through. But when you sat on a plane in a seat and you're next to someone you don't know, and your own face appears on your iPad,
it looks like you're watching yourself.
It's the most awkward thing ever. Yeah. But it was quite fun. The amount of times I just would get like a screenshot sent to me from different friends and different people that I knew just being like, you've just appeared on my TV. It was very cool. So it was a really fun thing to do. And I think it's really sort of helped the sport open itself up to some new fans.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So I've just got a question from one of our patrons, Samuel Harper, who just says, how much did Netflix chop up of what you were actually saying? And I'm sure it's heavily edited, but were you happy with what they picked? Or did you go, oh, no, I had a much better point about that later on? Or, you know...
I can never remember about a time that I made a good point, because they're rare anyway, but it was, most of it was completely clean and just sort of one flow of whatever you'd said. So there was hardly anything where I thought, that sounds a bit odd. But there was once or twice where, just for editing purposes, you could tell they'd shortened a sentence or shortened an answer. And I could hear that it just sounded a bit odd because it wasn't a complete flow. But I don't there was never anything where I thought, oh, that's putting words in my mouth. So they were pretty fair. And even in the interviewing, They were clearly pushed to go down a certain direction, because for anything like this, it needs to be entertaining. So there's a bit of a narrative they're using. But if I sat there and said, I actually don't agree with that, or I wouldn't say that, then they'd be like, fair enough, and move on. They weren't pushy and weren't trying to manipulate anything, which I thought was really good of them, because they created something very entertaining even without doing that.
You just touched upon Christian Horner there, and you said you did some work with Honda. So firstly, the Honda atmosphere must be a lot higher, a lot better, even though they didn't quite, you know, make it to the post in Hungary. Have you noticed that, you know, that's a nicer place to go and work?
Only slightly, to be honest. Certainly compared to the McLaren days, but that was a two-way street as well. A few too many people, I think, have been questioning McLaren's decision to ditch Honda recently because of what's happening with Red Bull. But we're 2 years later, and it's a completely different environment, completely different structure at Honda. They needed the fresh start as much as McLaren did. So I don't actually sort of think it's fair to criticise McLaren for that call. But similarly, yeah, the way it's working with Red Bull is, I think Red Bull learned from McLaren's mistakes and have given Honda a bit more freedom. And Honda, with the extra 2 years of development, have started to really close that gap. So yeah, it's better. But even then, their standards are so high within Honda that they're not satisfied, they're not happy, they're not patting themselves on the back. I'd say they're no more or less open than they were before. You can tell it's maybe a little bit less tense because they're getting better results and they're seeing progress. But yeah, they still feel they're a long way off where they want to be, because they want to be the best in the same way that everyone does. So no, that's quite good to see.
So I'm turning to you more as a pundit now. Forgive me, but I've got this chain of thought going. Where does the decision to give Honda a bit more freedom come from? I think, is it from Christian Horner, is my first question, because I know Renault were complaining about Adrian Newey and his very tight rear end and wanting to package everything really tightly. Is that Horner from the top who goes, no, do you know what, we're gonna go towards Honda's philosophy and let them off the leash a bit?
No, I'd say that's more a Toro Rosso philosophy, because it was off the back of the McLaren spell, the obvious and easy thing for Toro Rosso to do, because to them, it's the first time they'd had works status as such with their own manufacturer, was to go, right, we don't have the ability really to tell you what to do. Do what you want to do and we'll react to it as best we can, because obviously telling you what to do didn't work in the last phase. And you know, Toro Rosso had far less to lose than say Red Bull did, and that 1 year of good performance improvement and potential meant Red Bull could then go, oh okay, yeah, we'll carry on in this vein. And it's all through Red Bull Technology as the central kind of company that's working with both teams. But I think from that, Red Bull were able to learn a lot about a good way to approach working with Honda. And there's still demands that are made of them, and there's still pressure there. And part of it is just time and experience. I think if McLaren and Honda were still together now, 5 years into the relationship, then it would certainly be going better, just because things do improve over time. So it's just Red Bull kind of, the timing's worked out well for them, and they've learned from Honda's past in F1 recently and how well it went with Toro Rosso, that was the way to continue.
Oh, look, I would, if you don't mind, I would love to ask you just more questions about what it's like being a media journalist, but perhaps we could hook up a Q&A at some point to get more of your pundit kind of insights, if you don't mind, if the shed is comfortable. I know it's a little warm, I'm desperate to get that fan back on. How about some quickfire ones from the people that we've asked to provide them in our Slack group? We're going to give you a team boss situation. You're the team boss for 2020. All right, you're picking your drivers next season. You can only stick with one, Vettel or Leclerc.
Leclerc.
You're picking Leclerc, and would has that changed over the course of this season?
Yes, because I thought it might be a bit too much pressure too soon on Leclerc, and he still made some mistakes. He's clearly not the finished article, but he's clearly shown the potential to be a long term future bet. Whereas Seb doesn't look like he is actually quite that stable now.
Yeah, if they're kind of running evenish, which I think they are in points, aren't they? They're more or less even at the moment. And you go, well, is Vettel going to change? Is he going to improve? Or is Leclerc's right at the beginning? All right, then. Well, we'll take that away for the next one. We're assuming that Bottas is gone for 2020. Firstly, is that a fair assumption?
No, I don't think it is, because it would rock the boat making that change. So I think it's kind of, I'd say it's pretty 50-50 at the moment. If anything, I still think, ideally, Mercedes would like to hold on to him to keep the peace with Lewis. If it means they keep winning both titles, why would you change it?
Yeah, Lewis loves him, doesn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
Never said a bad word about him. And whenever Bottas gets a pole position, Lewis is always the first one running over going, well done, buddy. You know, great work. He never did that with Rosberg.
No, exactly. It's a much more harmonious relationship, and you can't knock Mercedes for doing it, looking at the success and the run they've had. And essentially, that's all they've got to keep doing, is keep winning both championships. So even if Bottas is disappointing at times and he's not making a real title fight of it, from Mercedes' point of view, as long as one of those two drivers wins the title, the other one scores enough points to win the Constructors, then they're doing their job.
Okay, well, given my unfair assumption that Bottas is gone for 2020, that's the one I'm going to stick with. I think they're going to let him go. Right, who would you pick then, Russell or Ocon?
Ocon, definitely.
Yeah.
I think it's just too soon to do that to George, and unfair. He's still unproven in a Williams. He's doing a very good job, it looks like. He's definitely got potential. But as we've seen with someone like Pierre Gasly, you get these drivers that are burned out by being stepped up too quickly. And that was the one doubt I had with Leclerc as well. And I think Ocon showed over a couple of years that he's got that potential, and he's got a little bit more experience. And realistically, he needs that chance to go and prove himself. Because, you know, that he's that little bit older and he's that little bit further down the development line. If it doesn't work with Ocon, then you've got Russell with an extra year of development to come in instead.
Fantastic. Russell's doing fantastically well, though. It will be interesting to see how he does against, you know, maybe somebody in a more traditional phase of their career, and hopefully in a midfield pack as well. No, I don't think, no disrespect to what Robert Kubica is doing at all. It's just that he's possibly not at his optimum at the moment. So you've got George Russell kind of in a wilderness zone where we can't fully assess him. But it looks like he's going well. Now, I just want to finish up by with one of Michael Dustelhoff's questions that he sent me, and it's about media. And now, a lot of the F1 demographic is a little older, but I think generally the demographic that listens to podcasts, so the ears this is falling on, are the guys that go on Twitter and will go on Reddit and will go on Facebook. He says, seeing as Chris seems a lot younger than Joe, we'll assume you are.
I'm 30, so
you're 30. All right, okay, yeah, that's
younger than Joe, just
only slightly. Are you using a different approach in the way of reporting? Are you seeing a difference in approach between the younger journos and the old guard? Michael is clear to state that he's not calling Joe a fossil, but Joe's generation has had a lot more time to build up relations, whereas everything's a little bit more quick fire now. So basically, have you noticed a drift towards the clickbait F1 or clickbait.com style of F1 reporting? Is there the room, is there the patience for you to do what you want to do as a journalist?
I think there is the room and the patience if you can build that reputation, and that's something that someone like Joe did very well, and the people that he works with. And obviously he can then call on different experience and liken the sport to the way it was in the past, and that's still appealing to a certain market, and it's just sort of appealing to different demographics with what you're working on. So with different outlets I work for, you write in a different style, and you gather different content. And I think it's more now that we have less freedom to talk, or less ability to go and talk to as many key people within a team, because the team sort of communications departments and PRs are very keen to protect and ring fence and only give you the access, like, if you've gone through them and if they agree to it. Sometimes they want to know what you're going to ask. And I think it's harder to build up relationships where you can go and have those chats off the record, not just from the point of view of from the journalist having the time to go and do it, because you can find that if you're determined enough, you can, and you can go and build those relationships. But for then the team member thinking, but our team don't like that, you know, we're not really meant to do that. And in the past, it was just a bit more accepted. So it's kind of changed in that sense. But I kind of quite like that. I like that you can have quite a widespread of age of journalists. And then they're sort of hitting different markets and providing different things. And that kind of gives space to more people, and means that it's not, you know, I know there's a lot of clickbait online, similar rehashed stuff. But then there is also some really unique bits as well. So I quite like that sort of variety.
But a journalist of your generation knows that he's going to have to answer immediately. So anything you say, any opinion you give, there's going to be someone on Twitter, or in our case, YouTube comments, who are going to tell us just exactly what an idiot we are.
Yeah, they're down there right now, I imagine, by the time people are watching this.
Yeah. Hi guys. And please do keep clicking the dislike button. It makes me feel like a proper legend.
Yeah, I'll enjoy that as well. No, to be fair, it's, you've sometimes got to have a bit of thick skin, but I've actually found rarely, if you're balanced with your arguments, people will accept that you have a different opinion. I've found on the whole, I still do get some criticism, but rarely. I tend to get quite good. I don't know, maybe I've just got lucky with the sort of follower group I've got, but most comments I get and responses I get, even if they're disagreeing with me, tend to be fairly well structured. And then you just sometimes got to accept that you're going to get ones that you really just can't argue with or can't respond to. But I just try and respond actually fairly often. Someone gives you a really unfair reaction to your opinion or a comment you make, then I think, well, engage with them, because you can almost educate them sometimes if you've got the time to say, well, it's because of this, I think that, or I don't agree with what you've just said for this reason. And half the time they'll ignore you, or they'll tell you to do one. And half the time they'll go, oh, I've never thought of it like that. Thanks for getting back to me. So you can actually open up some good conversations there. And I think that's where it's about not having too much an ego as a journalist, and not thinking just because I'm there and part of it, that means what I say goes. Yes, you can give people lots of access to your opinion and other people's opinions, but you then need to respect those from the people you're talking to as such.
Have a balanced and unbiased approach. Interesting. I'll think about it and see if that's something I can ever manage. Thank you so much for your time, Chris. I'd just like to leave you on one question. If you weren't living everybody else's dream of being in the Formula One paddock and following them around the world, what would you be doing?
I've honestly got no idea. Some sort of sports journalist still, because I got into it because I realized I wasn't good enough to be a professional sportsman in any discipline. So I thought, what's the next thing that I love doing most? And that's sitting and watching sport. So I was like, I'd rather get paid to do that. So I think I'd somehow have to work in sport or with cars in some form. So yeah, test driving cars would be quite fun. Maybe I'll do that.
Test driving cars. Chris Medlin, thank you very much for your time.
Cheers, guys.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc. Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.